Is it Mr. Ruggie?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the court. And I should note, Justice Miller-Lerman is recused in this case and also in the last case of the day. With that, Mr. Ruggie, you may proceed.
Your Honors, may it please the court. This case is a case about a property that, in essence, was, we allege, was wrongfully foreclosed upon. It comes to us on a ruling on a motion for summary judgment, and we believe that there is enough conflicting evidence there that at least my client should have his day in court. It's obvious from the judge's order that he didn't give much credibility to the position of my client, but I don't believe that that justified a ruling on summary judgment. My client testified, and I believe the read the depositions of Wells Fargo and my client, I believe there is plenty of evidence that my client was timely made the payments under the mortgage until the time that he applied for a HAMP modification. It is undisputed that he testified that at the beginning of the HAMP process that he was told to stop making payments until the three trial payments were made. There's no dispute that the three trial payments were made. If you read carefully the deposition of Wells Fargo, they waffle on why the foreclosure process went forward after the three trial payments were made. At one point, they say that requested that the loan be withdrawn. He denies that, and I would suggest if you read the, if you look at all the evidence in a light most favorable to my client, it defies reason as to why he would withdraw the HAMP modification application after the three trial payments. Wells Fargo also states that the loan was withdrawn because there was a cease and desist order in place. In other words, my client had ordered that Wells Fargo not contact my client. Then in connection with that, they say that they weren't able to clarify the second mortgage that was on the property. My client says that the second mortgage was already taken care of. There is plenty of communication documented there between Wells Fargo and my client. The fact that there was a cease and desist order in place and that is cited as a reason for denying the HAMP modification just doesn't hold water if you look at the evidence. Wells Fargo is sending out communication to my client. There's multiple telephone calls between my client and Wells Fargo. So Wells Fargo takes the position that the loan modification was eventually denied for unclear reasons, I would submit under the evidence, and then forecloses. Wells Fargo states, hey, we notified you that the modification was denied. My client says, no, you didn't, and then the foreclosure happens. There are some other aspects to this case. There's tortious interference with contractual relations related to service link, and there we allege contacts with the tenants on the property. Wells Fargo takes the position that, you know, we didn't know that there was contact with tenants or interference with tenants, but if you look at the deposition of Ms. Bradford, the representative from Wells Fargo, it's replete with reports about service link going to the property, reports indicating that it was owner-occupied, reports that the tenant occupied furniture in the property. It's clear that whether Wells Fargo read the reports or not, it had these reports about the property being occupied. There's also indications as to the demeanor of the person that they had contact with. My client testified that, you know, these service link people were harassing the tenants, demanding rent, and notified Wells Fargo that, you know, hey, stop that. So I know there's an issue there as to, you know, hearsay and what the tenants said, but I believe that at least my client's state of mind in informing Wells Fargo that, hey, this needs to stop comes into evidence. In short, I believe that the district court didn't give much credence to the evidence that my client has in his favor. And I understand that if we're back down in front of the judge, I've got a big uphill battle. But I also believe that my client is entitled to his day in court, and if he wants to present his case, and I think he's entitled to that. Are there any questions? Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Gutierrez, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Ruby. My name is Allison Gutierrez, and I represent the Wells Fargo Bank. The order appealed from by the district court had two parts. The first part was an award of summary judgment in favor of my client, Wells Fargo, and also a dismissal of the complaint. The second part of the order appealed from the Ruby did not address was a denial of the appellant's motion for recommend to add an additional defendant to the case. I'll address the summary judgment order first. As to the district court's order granting summary judgment in favor of Wells Fargo, the order was proper in all respects. Appellants brought four claims against Wells Fargo in the case. Three arose out of alleged wrongful foreclosure of the property. Those claims include a motion to overturn, or a claim seeking to overturn the foreclosure, a claim for by title, and a claim for declaratory judgment. These claims are all governed by the Nebraska Supreme Court case Gilroy versus Ryberg. That case states that a claim to set aside a wrongful foreclosure sounds in equity. Equity only grants a relief where there's a defect in the sale sufficient to overturn that sale. And the case makes very clear that these defects are rare and they only occur in the instance where a trustee simply did not have the power to move forward with the sale. And the case states, for example, where there's no underlying default giving rise to the sale. Here, the district court correctly concluded that Wells Fargo put on a prima facie case establishing that it was entitled to summary judgment on the grounds that there was no defect in the sale that occurred. Wells Fargo established evidence that Mr. Morgan entered into a note and deed of trust, that note and deed of trust was transferred to my client, Wells Fargo, and that Mr. Morgan defaulted under that note and deed of trust by failing to make payments since April 2012. Wells Fargo also established evidence that while Mr. Morgan did apply for a loan modification, this application did not cure the default because Mr. Morgan did not complete the steps necessary to fulfill his loan modification obligation by providing Wells Fargo information related to certain liens and title defects on the property and correcting those defects. And there is evidence in the record that shows that Wells Fargo was not able to contact Mr. Morgan to ask him to address these defects, but the evidence is very clear that Wells Fargo did send Mr. Morgan a written notice that his loan modification application had been denied. After denial of the loan modification, Wells Fargo sent Mr. Morgan a notice of his default and provided an opportunity to cure that default. After failure to do so, the trustee moved forward with the sale and did so properly under the Trust Deeds Act. The trustee reported a notice of default, sent that notice of default to Mr. Morgan by certified mail, and then published a notice of sale, sent the notice of sale to Mr. Morgan by certified mail, and subsequently conducted the sale at the time and place stated in the notice. All this evidence shows that there was no defect in the sale. The district court also properly concluded that Wells Fargo made an affirmative showing of entitlement to summary judgment as to appellant's fourth claim for tortious interference. Under Nebraska law, in order to state a claim for tortious interference and establish such a claim, a party must show, first, that there was a valid business expectancy, second, that the allegedly interfering party had knowledge of such business expectancy, third, that the interfering party created an intentional act of, an unjustified act of interference, and that that act caused damage. Wells Fargo made an affirmative showing in the first instance that it was not aware of any relationship between Midland Properties, who is not a borrower under the loan and had no relationship with Wells Fargo.
It wouldn't need that information anyway. All it had to do was foreclose its interest in the deed of trust that was given by the parties. Was there ever anything determined, or was it disputed that the mortgage was in default?
There was evidence. Mr. Morgan introduced an affidavit into the record, and that affidavit stated that he was current on the mortgage, but provided no factual detail actually supporting that conclusion. And there's a Nebraska Supreme Court case, Boyle v. Welch, that states when you make these general denials and conclusory allegations without sufficient supporting factual detail supporting these conclusory allegations, that those conclusions on their own are insufficient.
He could state that he wasn't in default, but he would then have to show the payments that he made to show that he had made the payments as required on the note and mortgage.
He did not make a showing.
Right, that's what I mean. You'd have to have something besides just to say, I'm not in default.
Right, if somebody could defeat summary judgment by simply saying I'm not in default, that every single person who ever defaulted on a loan would do so, but there needs to be evidence establishing details as to the lack of default supporting that the payments were made. And beyond this, although his affidavit stated that he was current, there was deposition testimony where he admitted, Mr. Morgan did, that he actually had missed payments on the note. So there's another Nebraska Supreme Court case, Pierce v. Landmark, that states specifically that you can't create a material issue of fact.
I think the significant fact is they sent notice to him of his right to cure the default, and there was no action taken on that notice.
Yes, Your Honor, I would
agree. Had he done that, then they wouldn't have been able to proceed with their deed of trust foreclosure, or their equitable foreclosure.
Right, and there's definitely evidence in the record that establishes that notice of default was sent to Mr. Morgan at the property address, and then also a separate P.O. box that Wells Fargo had on file for Mr. Morgan.
But he was given an opportunity to cure that default.
He was, yes.
And if he did that, then they wouldn't proceed on the foreclosure.
Correct. If he had cured the default after receiving the notice, they would not have proceeded with the foreclosure.
Some of these mortgages provide that if you default on one payment, the party can accelerate all of the balance due. Was that in this provision?
I don't know whether it stated that if he missed one payment they could accelerate. I know that there was a remedy of acceleration after an event of default that occurred and after notice of that default and an opportunity to cure had been provided. That was in the deed of trust, and that was complied with in the deed of trust. So Wells Fargo made its affirmative showing, and as Mr. Ruby argued, he claims that his client produced evidence of an issue of material fact. And the district court probably concluded that all of the evidence that appellants provided was insufficient because it didn't meet the standards under Nebraska law. It either was not made on personal knowledge, the evidence was inadmissible because it constituted hearsay, or the evidence was conclusory in nature and not supported by detailed facts that supported those conclusions that were made. So the district court's decision that there was no issue of material fact was proper because the evidence, while voluminous, was not acceptable to a defeat a motion for summary judgment.
Careful. And then, sorry for interrupting. After the summary judgment motion was granted and after the request for leave to file an amended complaint was denied, HBI and HS Partnership filed a motion to dismiss the counterclaims without prejudice. What's the purpose? What was the purpose of that filing?
The purpose of that filing was to make the order a final judgment for purposes of giving the Court of Appeals jurisdiction over the case, because without the dismissal, there still would have been technically a claim pending against Wells Fargo, and not all claims against all parties would have been resolved without that motion to dismiss. So after that motion to dismiss was filed, the cross-claim by HBI against Wells Fargo was resolved along with all other claims by the parties.
Thank you.
And I would also submit to the court that the motion, that leave to amend was also properly denied, both on the basis of timeliness and on the basis of futility. The motion was made very late in the game. It was over 2.5 years after the case had been filed, after Wells Fargo had filed for summary judgment, and just 2 months before the parties were supposed to be trial ready, and 9 months after the motion to amend deadline had passed. And as was argued to the district court, that late filing would have been extremely prejudicial to Wells Fargo, who had prepared its defense, conducted all discovery, based on the belief that it would be undergoing a theory of direct liability, and the addition of an additional defendant ostensibly would have been to add a theory of indirect liability to Wells Fargo for the alleged acts of a third-party service provider, ServiceLink, which at 2 months before trial was completely prejudicial to Wells Fargo. In addition, the amendment would have been futile under the standards set forth in Bailey versus First National Bank of Chadron, because there's no evidence in the record supporting it, which would have been required after a summary judgment was filed.
Do we know from the court's order ruling on that motion why the motion for leave to amend was denied? I mean, you've given us some possibilities, but can we tell from the order what the judge...
The order expressly states, at this late stage, the plaintiff has failed to show why ServiceLink should be added as a defendant. And that was the precise ruling, but earlier in the order, the district court did opine that there was no evidence in the record suggesting that ServiceLink had committed any tortious conduct that would have been conduct supporting the allegations in the complaint. So you can infer from that ruling by the district court that he believed that there would have been no evidence to support the amendment to add ServiceLink.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
4 minutes and
9 seconds. Mr. Ruge, we do have 4 minutes if you're interested.
Your Honors, briefly, as to the issue of default, it's not as clear as the Wells Fargo would make you believe. There is an issue there over force-placed insurance and some service fees that were alleged by Wells Fargo as due. My client maintains that he had insurance all along. Also, with respect to the loan modification denial, it was never stated as a reason for denial that, you know, he was in default. There is evidence in the record, if you look at Wells Fargo's documents, of regular monthly payments. Now, my client disputes, you know, the amounts, for example, the monthly payment amount that was due. My client disputes the force-placed insurance. So the issue of default is not as clear as Wells Fargo would make you believe. My client, there is evidence of a notice of default and cure. Wells Fargo, that's part of the record. My client denies receiving that. With regard to ServiceLink, I would agree that there would not be a adding ServiceLink as a party with denial of that. In a normal case, would 2 years in the case would probably not be an abuse of discretion. But keep in mind that this case had been stayed because of bankruptcy for 9 months. that when we first took the deposition of Wells Fargo in March of 2015, Wells Fargo had not produced all the documents that I had requested, and that became clear when I was taking the deposition of Ms. Bradford. And then they produced some documents, but they didn't want to produce these documents that were the agreement with ServiceLink, and they were important because I needed to know what ServiceLink was. Were they an independent contractor such that, you know, Wells Fargo could say that ServiceLink was acting outside of the scope of authority, or were they actually an arm of Wells Fargo employee, which would have a different aspect?
Whose bankruptcy stayed the proceeding?
I believe Mr. Morgan filed bankruptcy. I don't know if Midlands filed bankruptcy as well, but there was a stay in place.
Well, they could have requested relief from the stay, couldn't they? If they wanted to pursue their litigation diligently.
You mean Wells Fargo, Your Honor?
No, I'm saying if your clients could have requested leave from the stay.
Absolutely.
It seems a little bit disingenuous to say we couldn't be pursuing discovery because of our own bankruptcy proceeding. You could have been if you chose to do it.
Right. You're right. We could have. In fairness, though, everybody was idle during the bankruptcy.
Well, Wells Fargo was required to be idle. Unless they sought relief from the stay.
Right, they could have sought relief as well.
But of course, if you had sought it, it would, or your clients had sought it, it would have been granted without objection, wouldn't it?
Probably, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is ACI World.